Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. Three segments squeeze into tonight's hour. First, in a few minutes, we'll be hearing from Jerry Lemke, who is a sociologist at Holy Cross, talking about conspiracy theories, what the politics and appeal of those ubiquitous explanations of complex events are. Towards the bottom of the hour, a little before, we'll hear from John Bogle, who is a critic of Wall Street from the inside. He is certainly no radical by any means, but a knowledgeable critic of what's sick about our financial markets and their deleterious effect on the real economy. Bogle was the founder of the Vanguard Group of Mutual Funds. He's been in the financial business for over 50 years. And then finally, about 40 minutes into the show, we'll hear from Dean Baker, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. And he thinks that all these bailouts of big financial firms are not necessary, which I'm not fully in agreement with him on, so I want to ask him what's up. And maybe we can have an exchange of views, as the diplomats say. I'll keep the opening comments short, since there are a lot of interviews scheduled ahead. This week's economic news was pretty undramatic by recent standards. No major bankruptcies or bailouts. On Monday, we learned that sales of existing houses rose almost 3% between January and February. A bit of a surprise, and the first significant uptick in that measure in many months. But average prices were down almost 2%. The conclusion that most analysts drew from this is that sellers are capitulating and cutting prices, bringing buyers back into the market. While that's always possible, it's a bit of a stretch to conclude that from a single month's data. It could just be statistical noise. Sure enough, Monday's good news was partly reversed on Wednesday when we learned that sales of new houses, a much smaller market than that for existing dwellings, fell by almost 2% from January to February. I spent some time this week looking at some very long-term housing indicators, and I do mean long-term, almost 120 years worth, and I'm still thinking that we're only about halfway through this housing decline. On Tuesday, the Conference Board reported a sharp erosion of consumer confidence between February and March. High gas prices, the continuing implosion of the housing market, and the weakening job market are the major culprits. And speaking of that job market, on Thursday morning, the Labor Department reported a modest decline in first-time claims for unemployment insurance, in line with expectations and leaving the previous week's sharp rise largely intact. As I pointed out here before, there's been a general decline in turnover in the job market, with both hires and fires running at low levels by historical standards. So it may be that these jobless claims figures aren't as useful a guide to the labor market as they once were. Since employers didn't hire aggressively during the expansion, they may not be firing as aggressively during the contraction. Instead, the job market could just be eroding slowly. The Thursday morning also brought the release of the figures for corporate profits in the fourth quarter of 2007. Profits fell pretty hard at the end of the year. And while those of us, like me, of a Marxist bent, believe that profits originate in the uncompensated labor of workers, managers and owners park at a large share of the value that workers produce, profitability is a measure of the long-term health of the capitalist system by its own standards. And by that measure, the system is looking progressively less healthy. This confirms my sense that the U.S. economy isn't just coping with a recession, it's coping with some serious structural problems, which will give us a lot to talk about in the coming months. Oh, and a personal kvetch. I've noticed that the celebrations and memoirs of 1968 are all the rage these days. It was a popular topic at the recent Left Forum in New York, and has been the subject of a week of readings at my local Barnes & Noble. Tariq Ali, a man I like and admire a lot, has a piece in Thursday's Guardian on that memorable year. I'll concede that there was much that was great about 1968, but it was 40 years ago. That was before most living Americans were born. Too many of us on the left are living in the past. We remember 1968, we replay the speeches of Malcolm and Martin, and not to mention all those boring old albums by the Grateful Dead. We'd better spend our time by figuring out how to appeal to people today. The right is tired, the economy is in bad shape, and there's a hunger for analysis and change. So let's turn our attention to the present, okay? And to mark 1968, all the music on this show will come from that year, but will have nothing to do with what people usually think of when they hear those numerals. Here's our first taste. And then a bit of Austin Siebentagen by Karlheinz Stockhausen, composed in 1968, during early May when the events were going on in Paris, but apparently Stockhausen was unaware of them. That in a piano realization by Elisabeth Klein, the late Danish pianist, recorded that when she was 87 years old. I hope I can still even climb a stair when I'm 87. We're now joined on the line by Jerry Lemke, who is a professor of sociology at Holy Cross, and as the author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, and CNN's Tailwind Tale, Inside Vietnam's Last Great Myth. Welcome to Behind the News.
Oh, thanks. Good to be with you.
Conspiracy theories. You've certainly written a lot about tales, inventions that people have about the past, persistence in inventions about the past. But what is it about conspiracy theories? Why are they so popular? They used to be, Richard Hofstadter wrote about them as being a characteristic of the political right. Now they've moved across the spectrum, and now they're all over the left. What do you make of this? Why is that going on?
Well, I think they're attractive to the left because the left has lost some of its own impetus and organizationally has kind of fallen on hard times in the last couple of decades, and so you have people casting around, drifting around, looking for ideas, looking for insights. And some of them are drawn to ideas that emanate from the right. And also, conspiracism has some kind of deep roots in American culture, too, which Hofstadter wrote about, and being rooted in fundamentalist Christian beliefs and needing to find, causes for things in bad individuals and people who can be held accountable for things that go wrong in their world.
Well, it does seem to conspiracy theories generally ascribe a great deal of power to a small number of people who can meet in secret and control events.
Right.
First of all, how plausible is that scenario? Is that the way history works?
Well, no. I think, for one thing, I think history is full of a lot of contingencies, and You can't always find simple answers and concrete answers and single causes for social events. And of course, that was one of the features that that came out of the Enlightenment period was the effort to find single causes, to reduce things to identifiable reasons for social events happening. And no, I don't think it's not always good social science, although it's inspired by scientific method, that is the attempt to find causes for things. But in the social world, things aren't always that simple.
Many of us on the left have tried to provide structural analyses of how the system, capital T, capital S, works, which involve certainly powerful institutions, Council on Foreign Relations, and as classics. And we think of classes, ruling classes, ruled classes. So there are these structures of power and institutional manifestations of those structures of power. How do you differentiate that kind of institutional analysis from a more strictly conspiratorial one?
Well, institutions. Have a chemistry within themselves and chemistry with each other, and things set in motion, don't always respond to human intervention. And people can be the people in those institutions, as the saying goes, can be made by the institutions themselves. We know expressions like power corrupts tells us that. You put people in certain situations, and the situations make the people. History makes people, and so you can't always explain why things that are good. You can't always explain it through the intervention of people with good intentions. And likewise, when things go bad, you can't always find individuals to blame for that. And the attempt to do so probably leads you further away from. Really valid explanations for why things happened the way they did.
What is it about 9/11 that makes it such rich ground for conspiratorial thinking?
Well, 9/11 is the motherlode of conspiratorial thinking.
At least since the Kennedy assassination.
Right. You know, it was a totally unexpected and sort of totally implausible event in the minds of probably most Americans that leaves people very befuddled as to why something like this could have happened. And so, understandably, I guess, in some ways, you know, people go in search of explanations for it, and you know, handed quick and sort of ready-made explanations, you know, such as Osama bin Laden, an organization called Al Qaeda, is very, very inviting, very attractive to people to glom onto that and take that as the explanation.
And what about the Kennedy assassination, if we go back? I mean, what is it? What's the appeal of that? Why has that been such a rich ground for conspiratorial speculation?
I don't, you know, I'm not a historian of that event, and you know, I don't. I might not be the best person to ask about that. A lot of the conspiracism around that, I think, though, you know, grew as time went on. You know, popular culture, film, fiction writers, you know, people developing those kinds of scenarios as time went on. I mean, a lot of it was fed by Cold War scenarios and Cold War themes, you know, having to do with the CIA and Cuba and those types of things. A very different time period, I think, probably quite a different logic to that than to the post 9/11 conspiracism.
Well, it also seems that there's this tendency in conspiracists, what you talked about this to yourself, that to see good and bad individuals, and Kennedy was some sort of good guy who was going to take us out of Vietnam, so he had to be eliminated
right.
for that reason, which has little to do with the Kennedy, I understand, but
yeah,
that is
right.
the Kennedy of myth. You also have been critical of the, that Move On General Petraeus campaign, in which they took out an ad identifying General Petraeus as General Betraeus.
Right.
Why were you critical of that? What's
wrong
with
that? I thought it was a really interesting. You know, to use that word, you know, Betraeus was obviously an attempt to appeal to sentiments within Move On's constituency, which is a liberal left liberal. A constituency, and they evidently thought that this sort of betrayal, this reach out to a betrayal sentiment, fear of betrayal in the left would be attractive. But what interested me about that is that betrayal narratives usually come from the right. I mean, it's almost a watchword for political right and conspiratorial rights, because betrayal is very central. To that, and it really struck me as interesting and kind of odd that MoveOn.com would be making this pitch to its constituency. And then, what was also interesting about it is that the criticism of it came not from the left, but came from some quarters of the right. You know, I guess criticizing MoveOn as being, you know, anti-American or appealing to anti-American sentiments.
So they're just trying to pin the betrayal tag on somebody, both sides of this.
I guess, yeah. Yeah, it was a very curious a development as I saw it.
Now, the attitude towards government, which you've also talked about, I mean, coming from the right, it makes sense in some sense. They're very, you know, generally anti-government. Although they adopted the strange line that our leaders were working for the communist conspiracy. But what is it on the left, which has historically not always been as hostile to government as the American right has been?
Well, the government has not always been the greatest supporter of union movements and other left movements. They've impinged on the constitutional rights of union activists, anti-war activists. Civil rights activists, and the FBI has infiltrated the civil rights movement, you know, infiltrated the anti-war movement, carried out provocative activities within these organizations. And so I think the left has good reason to be hesitant, a little bit suspicious itself of what the government is up to, and so there's a kind of a common ground there that I think that the right and the left share in their skepticism of the government. And you know, different time periods, different generations of people on the left have different views of the government too. And I think that the generation coming out of the anti-war movement in the period of the 1960s and the 1970s had a kind of libertine culture to it, which made it a little less friendly to government power, and again lent it to appeals that are more commonly associated with the libertarian right.
Then what about the role of Christianity? You mentioned this, but what is it about Christianity's doctrine that so informs a lot of conspiracy thinking?
It's Christianity, but it also is Old Testament stories too, that Satan, the devil, oftentimes masquerades as ultimate good, and the devil does his work by deceiving people, by misrepresenting himself to people, and by masquerading as good, leads people, you know, down a bad road, down a dangerous path. And I think that it's that masquerading plays on people's fears of the unknown, what they can't see. What they don't know is the thing that has to be that people have to be fearful of. And the United States, being a very large country, means that central federal government is physically very far removed from people, and because it is for many people unseen, untouchable, in many ways a kind of unknown to people out in the heartland across the country, it has that feel of something to be feared to it. And then when the government presents itself to people as being the salvation for their problems, having the solution to their problems, there's a kind of twining there of Christian themes that raise some warning bells for people. Here you have something that is out of reach, out of touch. You can't see it. You don't really know what it is, and yet it's presenting itself to you as something good, something you should trust, something you should believe in. And those warning bells start to go off. Those yellow flags start to come up, and then people who are seeking to win you over, win people over to Christian beliefs, then they get a hearing with those people, and can pull people into a little bit deeper into a Christian rendition of these kinds of stories and these kinds of fears.
We've only got about 30 seconds remaining, but what do you do when someone starts talking about 9/11 stories in your meeting or your conference?
Well, I've had this experience a few times, and I've seen the situation handled very well, usually just by one person or two people engaging them in an intense discussion and moving off to the side and talking through the issues in a somewhat private way, and giving them a hearing. Oftentimes these days people are passing out literature, and of course you have to let that happen. You can't really exclude them. But neither can you let them take over a meeting, and I haven't really seen that happen too often. I think it can be handled pretty diplomatically most of the time.
All right, well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Jerry Lemke, who is a professor of sociology at Holy Cross College and interviewed on Counterpunch. If you want to read more about this, February 27th edition, I guess. I don't know if you call it that on the web, of Counterpunch, posted February 27th. Thanks for joining us, Jerry, and let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with John Bogle. And had a bit of another 68 thing, Safe as Milk, the song from Strictly Personal, the album by Captain Beefheart released that year. The album Safe as Milk was released the previous year, but the song was on the one in 68. Go figure that out. And this is Behind the News here on WBAI, 99.5 FM on your radio dial, and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And since this next interview is going to run through the half-hour mark, that's why that idea is coming a little early. John Bogle is the founder of the Vanguard Group of Mutual Funds and a persistent critic of Wall Street, very much from the inside, however. You're certainly not going to get any radical analysis out of him, but I thought this was worth a listen to hear his point of view on why the financial markets keep seizing up and what it all means. Interview recorded earlier this week, John Bogle. Thank you for joining us, John Bogle. The financial markets are in a total uproar these days, threatening to throw the real economy into a serious recession if we're not already in run. How did we get to this sorry pass?
Well, a whole bunch of different reasons. First, probably is the too much cheap credit. The availability of credit was made thanks to the Federal Reserve and some other factors for many years cheaper than it really should have been. It was easy to borrow. Second, the standards set by lenders to demand of borrowers just fell way down. Credit was not only therefore ripe and plentiful, but was issued to people without good credit standing. In other words, we took much too much risk. We did that in part because of an interesting thing that happened that is very atypical of earlier eras, and that is the people that were selling offering these loans and lending money to say mortgage holders immediately sent the loans to somebody else, a big financial institution, collateralized debt obligation, which was basically bonds based on these mortgages. So if you're not even going to hold the mortgage paper, you're obviously not going to care very much about quality. And number four, I guess, the credit rating agencies just did a poor job. They have a terrible conflict of interest. They get paid not by analysts who want to see what the paper is worth, but by issuers who want to get as many AAA ratings as they possibly can and will play with the numbers, and still they do. Fifth, I think, was the flood of speculation into the market. I've described what we've had in recent years as an orgy of speculation. There's never been a time in American history where turnover in the stock exchange has been as high as it was today. The previous high in 1929, stocks turned over about 140% a year. Last year, they turned over at exactly double that number, 280%. That means the market gets dominated by speculators, is dominated by speculators, rather than by long-term investors. And finally, I think I've got most of the worst ones here. We had this tremendous change over decades from stocks being held by individuals to stocks being held by financial institutions. And financial institutions owned about 8% of stocks 50 years ago. Today they own 74%. The market has become institutionalized. And these institutions are far more engaged in speculation than they are in investment. They're the ones that are turning over the portfolios at these rapid rates. And then I guess finally I'd have to add the hedge fund boom. The hedge funds account for maybe 5% of all the equity fund assets in the country, but account for something like 40%, 35 or 40% of the trading on the New York Stock Exchange. So hedge funds are by their nature short-term investors. So we basically had the triumph of speculation over investment, and investors have always paid a big price when these things happen, and they're paying a big price now.
You make a very long list that pretty much amounts to the entire financial landscape today. We have to go back to square one and redesign the whole thing to avoid a repetition of this?
Well, yes and no, I guess, is a fair answer to that. And number one, there is sooner or later, the attitudes of investors have to change. Everybody knows that speculation is a loser's game and that investment is a winner's game because corporate America and corporate the world, global corporations, earn a return on their capital. And that's where stock market returns come from. When you're starting to play guessing what other people will think about stock prices today or tomorrow or a month from tomorrow, that's speculation. And speculation is not, I guess you could say, bad as such, but it's bad because it costs more money. You know, for the investors who do nothing, they capture the market return. And for investors who are trading back and forth with another, they capture the market return less all those croupier costs.
Yeah, let's talk about those costs for a minute. The evidence is that really actively managed portfolios, which is what, of course, money managers are paid so highly for, don't really outperform the broad market and may even by some measures consistently underperform the broad market. People may know this, but yet they want to be the ones to beat the averages. How do we get around that kind of conundrum?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of investors are going to have to learn by experience. You know, I've been around a long time, and my own view is that it's a good idea to learn from the experiences of others and not yourself. But most people are not that way. And so they have to learn to play this game. They'll learn that as a group they will lose. They have too much confidence. You know, we all think we're above average drivers and above average in personality and above average in looks and God knows what else, above average in intelligence. We think we're above average stock pickers or mutual fund pickers. So that attitude is a big part of the problem. The innate urge to gamble, to get into one fund and out of another, is a gambling kind of a thing, and it's a reflection of your overconfidence in your ability to pick things. It's an unawareness, I think, of the numbers. You know, in an 8% market, investors as a group will obviously earn 8%, but investors who are playing games will earn maybe 6%. People seem to be unaware of that fundamental relationship. And we're also past performance chasers. If a fund has done well, we think that manager has the holy grail. And that just isn't true on the record. Picking funds based on their past superior performance is a loser's game because there's a great deal of, you know, returning to the average, as we call it, reversion to the mean in manager returns. And funds get big, and they can't do what they did when they were small. So, and there's also that, think about the securities industry for a moment. It's a giant marketing business. Every day, securities salesmen have to sell something. Otherwise, they will come to the end of the month with no income. And it's very hard to act responsibly when your livelihood depends on selling something to somebody, when obviously somebody on the other side is buying it. And together, it's a zero-sum game. But for the two of them together, because of the croupier cost, it's a loser's game. So the selling pressure, people telling you, I can help you to do better, or here's the fund you want to own, or here's the stock you want to own, is puts a lot of pressure on the investor to say, look, I want none of that. Very few people have the guts to do that.
I'm speaking with John Bogle, who's the founder of the Vanguard Group of Mutual Funds and a prominent critic of Wall Street from the inside. There are obviously some people, George Soros, Warren Buffett, who consistently make high returns over time and have earned a fortune doing so, but that's not typical experience. Is the whole money management industry kind of a gigantic, I don't know, fraud may be a strong word, but misleading in its fundamentals? The money managers as a class really beat the averages?
No, the record isn't. I mean, how could they? You know, the market is dominated by money managers. They're the ones that are making the market more than individuals. I mean, as I mentioned, 3/4 of the stock is owned by basically institutions run by money managers. And so the average, the money managers are trading with each other. And so the average money manager is, by definition, average. I mean, that doesn't seem to be an earth-shaking disclosure. The average money manager is average. How could it be otherwise? And so they tie the market before their costs, trading costs and management fees and the like are deducted, and lose to the market after the deduction of those, what I call croupier costs. So I guess I'd say this. Collectively, the money management business is a giant scam. Individually, these money managers aren't scamming. They believe in themselves. You know, if you ask, and I did this many, many, many years ago, we took a little poll for the, I think it was the first or second annual report of our Vanguard Index Fund, which was then called First Index Investment Trust. Now it's Vanguard Index 500. And we asked 100 managers or so, and did they expect to beat the market in the next 10 years? And in round numbers, 95% said they expect to beat the market in the next 10 years. Then we asked, somewhat gracelessly, for a show of hands, of how many had beaten the market in the previous 10 years. And about 45% or 40% had beaten the market in the previous 10 years. They all expect to be the winners looking ahead. You need a lot of optimism to be in that kind of frame of mind and a lot of basically unrealism.
We've now had, almost, I guess, 20 years of the so-called shareholder revolution, shareholder activism, CalPERS and other institutional investors getting involved in corporate management. What's the report card on that? Has it worked out?
Well, I've never seen a good statistical study on that, but I think on balance, the responsible state and local pension plans have been a plus in calling corporate governance and corporate managements to task. CalPERS is a good example, but these state and local governments pension plans own only about 8 or 9% of all stocks, so they can't change the world. And the union plans are part of that 8 or 9%. And between the two, the union plans and the state and local government plans have their own, unfortunately, political objectives. You know, they're going to be union in orientation because that's what their constituency is. A teachers union, for example, is going to be among the largest stockholders in America, teachers unions of the various state. And so they're very sympathetic to political issues. So we still haven't got to where we have a whole large, dominant cadre of investors that are saying, here's what I want to do to make the value of this corporation higher. And so we have a long way to go on that score.
And finally, at the outset, you listed a whole lot of pathologies that affect the financial system. A lot of them, the perverse incentives and the opacity of the instruments that they've created, and a general failure of supervision and regulation by the part of the Federal Reserve and others. Do you think a space for re-regulating the financial system now that we've experienced this very scary disaster?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. We need additional regulation. One of the commonplaces of the last quarter century is regulation backing down in ways large and small, regulators backing down, regulations being reduced very, very broadly. And among the worst of them, I think, was the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. That's an act in 1933 that separated investment banking from commercial banking. And that law was actually repealed in 1999. So now we have investment banks mingling with commercial banks. And it wasn't healthy in the 20s. That's why we, in the 1920s, that's why we got the Glass-Steagall Act, and isn't healthy now. So I would begin by at least considering bringing back the Glass-Steagall Act. But we also need tougher regulations in a lot of other areas. For example, the issuance of mortgages ought to have much better standards. There ought to be better qualifications, higher qualifications, compared to no qualifications to go out there and borrow money on a mortgage. And we live, as I mentioned, in this situation where those standards have gone way down because they're not held by your friendly banker, those mortgages in your local neighborhood bank. They're thrown into a financial instrument that, for all we know, may be reposing in China or Russia or Paris, who knows where. Yes, more regulation, absolutely.
And then what about getting our hands around some of these complicated securities, the CDOs and the inverse floaters and everything that maybe only a handful of math geeks understand? Is there any hope of getting those, wrestling those to the ground?
Well, I mean, the hope is, I guess hope can be subsumed by that ancient aphorism, once burned, twice shy. You know, you would think that these institutions that have been badly burned by all that immeasurable, imponderable complexity would not do it again. But I always had a rule of thumb that if you couldn't understand the instrument, don't own it. Let somebody else own it. But that's where kind of greed comes in. People are reaching for, particularly with interest rates relatively low levels, people are out there reaching for higher returns. And then if you can't get the returns high enough through buying riskier financial instruments, lever them, use a lot of borrowed money with them, and that's the way you bring your return up. Well, all that's fine when everything works well. When it falls apart, it doesn't work very well at all. So we certainly need far better and more stringent capital requirements and balance sheet requirements and portfolio quality requirements for these banks and investment banks. And, it's really, I think, interesting that the bankers and investment bankers for years have said, no, we want to let the free market prevail. Let's let Adam Smith in here. Let's each do our best to make the whole ball of wax better for everybody. Well, as soon as trouble comes, they don't want the free market anymore. They want the government to come in and bail them out. I mean, that seems kind of uneven, doesn't it?
Yes, it does seem kind of uneven. That we just heard the voice of John Bogle, who is the founder of the Vanguard Group of Mutual Funds. Been in the mutual fund business since, I believe, 1951, which is just barely before I was born. A prominent critic of Wall Street from the inside. He is certainly not going to get any radical critique out of him. You could hear his disdain for unions and his interest in making corporations function better, whatever that means, better for whom, doing what, how. But his analysis of why the financial markets are so pathological these days is certainly worth listening to. And now we're joined on the line by Dean Baker, who was the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C., and certainly one of the more prominent voices in recent years who, during the bubble, worried about what was going to happen when the housing mania came to a halt, and, of course, now has got his hands full. Now that it has come to a halt, it is causing so much trouble. So what's your guess? How far are we through this housing thing?
Maybe about a third. I mean, what's happened is prices are now dropping very rapidly. The annual rates of price decline over the last 3 months now is around 15-16% in nominal terms. If that were to continue over the course of the next year or so, I think we'd be largely back to sort of reasonable price levels. Of course, there are huge differences in different parts of the country. I mean, in some areas, there wasn't that much of a bubble to begin with, so we're pretty much back to normal prices, places like Detroit, Cleveland, maybe even below normal. On the other hand, you know, places like San Diego, Tampa, Miami, and actually the East Coast cities, New York and D.C., we still have a long way to go yet. So we're closer to the beginning than the end here.
Well, how do you figure out what normal would be? Is like price-income ratios?
Price-income ratios, I think the best thing to look at is rent, sales price to rent ratios. And, you know, you just find those are hugely out of line that in almost every case, you know, if you ignore appreciation, depreciation, you'd be a lot better off renting than owning in, you know, in these bubble inflated markets. Whereas, you know, taking a place like Cleveland or Detroit, you know, you could get, in many cases, you know, very nice housing at a pretty low price. In many cases, you might be better off, you know, just month to month with your mortgage and ownership payments rather than renting.
Well, I'm sitting here on Wall Street, ironically enough, and the finest minds in this neighborhood are saying, or many of them are saying, that the market is sort of finding a bottom. We're moving sideways now. The new and existing house sales came out earlier in the week, showed some signs of stability. You don't buy that.
I don't know what numbers they're looking at, frankly. I mean, I saw the headlines. I saw those people saying that, but you know, the existing home sales did show a little uptick in February relative to January. Important thing to keep in mind, existing home sales are reporting an actual sales. And, of course, there's typically 6 to 8 weeks between when a contract is signed and when the home is actually sold. So the homes that were sold in February almost invariably were contracted in December and January. So in that sense, it's sort of a lagging indicator. The better number, if we want to know what the market was looking like in February, is the data that we got later in the week. We got yesterday. New home sales, and those are contracts, and those were down again. In fact, the lowest level since 95. So not much uptick in, not much of evidence uptick in sales. But the other part of the story, of course, is the price, and that's just plummeting. And that was plummeting in the existing home sales. It was plummeting in the Case-Shiller indices that were released the next day, released yesterday. So, you know, there's a very modest uptick, which I should point out, almost all of that was in the Northeast. That raised the question of some of that being due to better, somewhat better than usual weather for those months in the Northeast. But in any case, the evidence is prices are falling very, very rapidly. And if nothing else, I could just say prices don't go from falling very rapidly to flat. I mean, what they'll do is they'll go from falling rapidly to falling less rapidly, and then somewhere down the road they'll be flat. So we have a long way to go.
And what about the economic fallout?
Well, it's going to be huge. And this, again, I still think people don't realize the enormity of the problem we're seeing. You know, a lot of people are saying, well, we're through the worst of the subprime, which may well be true. But, of course, the whole point was the problem never was subprime. Subprime is a small portion of the market. I mean, not to minimize the difficulties incurred by the people who actually had subprime mortgages who were caught up in that mess. That's a real big deal, and those people are really suffering. But it's actually a problem for the housing market as a whole. So in terms of the loan write-downs that we've seen to date, that's, you know, maybe a third, maybe just a quarter of what we're going to end up seeing. My bet is over $1 trillion, and I used to be the crazy bear on this, and I heard Goldman Sachs is now saying $1.2 trillion, so I guess I'm conservative. But, you know, we're going to see a lot more write-downs. And, of course, the bigger thing, we don't, most of us don't care much how much the banks are writing down. The bigger issue is what's happening to the economy. As people lose this housing wealth, you know, there's two stories. One is the immediate impact on the economy. They're going to cut back their consumption. That is why we're having the recession. I mean, there's not much of a mystery here. People have already lost over $2.5 trillion in housing wealth. They're cutting back consumption both because they're not as rich as they thought they were. They don't have the equity in the home they thought they had. But secondly, in many cases, people are literally borrowing directly against their equity to support their consumption, often of necessity. That was the only way they could make ends meet, was to borrow against the equity in their home. And now that prices have fallen, many people have no equity they can borrow against. The other part of this story, and again, this just you know, is infuriating to me as someone who's worked on Social Security for years. In many cases, in most cases, in fact, the only asset that families had as they approached retirement was their home, the equity they had in their home. And for, you know, millions, I should say tens of millions of households, they're seeing that just disappear. You have, you know, probably close to 20% of households now that have zero equity in their home. And in many cases, these are people in their 50s, even 60s, who are right at the edge of retirement, and they thought they had $100,000 in their home 2 years ago, and now they're finding they have zero. And that's a pretty bad situation to be in.
Now, what about the financial fallout? We've seen a whole lot of financial institutions go to the wall, and, of course, the Federal Reserve did their, whether bailout is the right word, but their emergency maneuver for Bear Stearns. You've been sharply critical of that. First, lay out your critique.
Yeah, well, the basic story here is we have an interest in keeping the financial system operating, preventing a freeze-up. So the idea that you would keep a Bear Stearns or other financial institution from, you know, just liquidating and freezing up and being brought into bankruptcy court and, you know, having tied up in years of litigation, we don't want to see that happen because, you know, this whole chain reaction you could get of, you know, they default on their obligations to other financial institutions who then default. I mean, that's what you get in, you know, the Great Depression, a chain reaction, a massive bank collapse. We don't want that. The Fed's right to prevent that. The issue here is that we have no interest in giving money to the people who got us here, and that means the managers of Bear Stearns, the people who drove it into bankruptcy, nor the shareholders. I mean, they took a bet. You know, if they made a lot of money, they aren't going to share that with us, and, you know, it turns out their bet went bad. They don't have any money. Their company's bankrupt. We don't have any interest in helping those people out. And what the Fed did with the bailout, at least initially, I wasn't that upset about. You know, we were talking about $250 million. I'd just assume it'd be zero, but, you know, given that, you know, the stock was selling at 100 times that price a year ago, couldn't get that upset about that. So, you know, they were originally talking about having J.P. Morgan buy up Bear Stearns for $250 million, and the Fed threw in this big sweetener of a $30 billion guarantee that in the event that Bear Stearns' assets went bad, the Fed was good for $30 billion, you know, covering any losses that J.P. Morgan might incur. Now, what happened was that there was this revolt of Bear Stearns stockholders, and they went back and renegotiated and got another billion out of J.P. Morgan. And this sort of raises the question, did J.P. Morgan pay $1.2 billion for Bear Stearns, or do they pay $1.2 billion for a $30 billion guarantee from the Fed? And it sure looks to me like it's the latter, because, you know, if they want to buy Bear Stearns, they could do that any day of the week. They don't have to call up the Fed. That's their business. I mean, the regulatory issues, but for the moment, we'll just say that's their business. But that wasn't the case here. They're getting money from the Fed, and I just don't like the idea of the Fed, in effect. What that means is the Fed is paying Bear Stearns stockholders, and we just have no interest in that. Now, at a deeper level, what Bernanke did when he said, and this is pretty explicit, when he came to, you know, to save Bear Stearns as such, he said that with the other investment banks, these are banks totally outside the Fed's jurisdiction, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, these are not commercial banks where you or I might, you know, have a checking account or savings account or get a mortgage. These are investment banks that underwrite stock issues, bond issues, make all these exotic financial instruments. They're kind of cowboys. They do what they want. They're outside of the Fed's regulation. He said, we're going to take care of you. If you go under, we're going to insure all the obligations you have. And that's enormously invaluable to a Goldman Sachs or Lehman Brothers, because what happened, and the reason Bear Stearns got in this mess, was that they made far more commitments than they were able to honor. Basically, their commitments were in the form of credit default swaps, which are basically insurance. They were insuring bonds. And Bear Stearns could have covered, you know, the loss of one or two or three bond issues. They couldn't cover the loss of, you know, hundreds or thousands of bond issues. They sold insurance that they weren't able to honor. And what Bernanke said was, well, we know Goldman Sachs doing that. We know Lehman Brothers is doing that. And if it turns out that they get in trouble, we're here to fill the gap. And the point here is it's Goldman Sachs that's collecting the fees. It's Lehman Brothers that's collecting the fees, not the Fed.
But so, now, these banks are in the same situation that the commercial banks were in the early 30s. So if Goldman Sachs or Lehman or any of these guys goes under, they're going to drag a lot of people down with them. So they could set off exactly that kind of chain reaction of failure that you were saying contributed a great deal to the creation of the Great Depression. I mean, we may not like it, but do we have a choice?
Well, we do have a choice in the sense that we don't have to – we have to keep them operating. We don't have to – keep the management whole. We don't have to keep...
Well, Bear Stearns, I mean, the management's gone. The stockholders have they're not as bad off as they were in the initial version, but they've been largely wiped out. A lot of people are out of jobs. So Bear Stearns is not a pleasant precedent for anybody.
Well, actually, we don't know what happened to the management. I mean, I'm hoping J.P. Morgan dumps them, but that's their call. I mean, I would have been very happy to see their management just, you know, thrown out on the street. But, you know, my model here would be what happened with Northern Rock in England, where basically it was just taken over by the government, and they threw out the management, the shareholders got nothing. And that way we know that's going to happen. But the other part of the story...
Well, no, but the government, the British government is actually on the hook for tens of billions of pounds. We don't really know how much.
No, that's right.
And Northern Rock also, like, hived off some of its best assets in an offshore company and left the British government with some of the crap. So I'm not sure that that's really a great model, is it?
Well, the advantage is to step in early before they have the opportunity to offload the good assets.
Yeah, well, and then the Bank of England and the British Treasury dithered for weeks as...
Yeah, no, they should have moved more quickly. But, you know, at the end of the day, that was the right thing to do rather than to allow them to continue to operate. But the point here, let me get back to where we're sitting at the moment, because what they've done with Goldman Sachs, it's just one bank, Bear Stearns, but there are many other investment banks out there, or at least several other very big investment banks, that Bernanke has, I was going to say implicitly, I'd say pretty explicitly said he's going to guarantee their obligations. So they're still going out there issuing credit default swaps and making other commitments where they're collecting the fees. But they know that the Fed is the one making good on the obligation. I mean, that's what I think is the biggest problem in the current situation. On top of that, he's also opened up the discount window, so he's allowing them to borrow money at below market interest.
Well, the problem is not what they're continuing to issue, but the trillions of dollars of junk that they've already issued and that's on their books, that if that goes bad, the whole financial system collapses and we're in trouble.
Well, I agree. We have to honor those commitments, but the point is they probably are continuing. Let me put it this way. If they've agreed to stop carrying on business, they haven't told anyone that, not publicly. So they might very well, I would assume they're continuing to make commitments that, given that they've already made more commitments than they're prepared to honor, I don't really see why we should be letting them do that.
Well, now, I would agree that we shouldn't extend all this largesse without some sort of like serious re-regulation of this gang. So you're in D.C. We keep hearing whispers up here of talk of re-regulation. What are people talking about, and how substantial is it?
Well, there's a lot of talk about it. I mean, I think it's safe that nothing much will happen, you know, during the current Congress, you know, with, you know, the election year coming up. I think it's safe that nothing will happen. I mean, there might be some voluntary rules on disclosure. But, you know, I think the idea is that you'd have to have more transparency, perhaps some reserve requirement. The Fed has to have access to the books. I mean, it's absolutely crazy that you have a story where you could have the investment banks, you know, issuing however much by way of debt swaps that, you know, there's no record of at the Fed. And then, you know, if they run into trouble, then the Fed will come in and bail them out. So there has to be some idea that, you know, there's disclosure here. Now, the question is, how transparent is this? How much of that would be made public? Will they be obligated to keep some sort of reserves? Will there be some fees paid? You know, those would be the big questions. But, you know, I really doubt we're going to see any action along those lines in this session of Congress.
Now, Obama gave a speech today in which he touched on some of these issues. I didn't really have a chance to do more than skim it. Did you have any impression of what he said?
Yeah, I mean, he sort of hit the right keywords. I mean, he talked about re-regulating the financial markets. I mean, part of the story, part of the reason we're in this mess is that we went through this process of deregulation in the 80s, in particular the 90s, and the repeal of Glass-Steagall Act in, I think it was 98, was sort of the last straw there, where we, you know, allowed commercial banks and investment banks basically to operate together. We removed the firewalls there. And he's, you know, he said that we'd gone too far in deregulation and that we wanted to move back to, you know, modernized regulation. He talked about regulating by function, which, again, makes a lot of sense because, you know, we have banks that issue mortgages, and the banks that issue mortgages are subject to Fed regulation. On the other hand, you have finance companies, you know, the countrywides are basically unregulated. So, you know, you had the regulatory structure that we have in place really doesn't make sense. You know, concretely, what would President Obama do? You know, I can't say. I mean, he's using the right words, but, you know, really a lot of it will come down to nuts and bolts. And some of it would just be, you know, literally, who are the people you put in there? Are they, you know, Wall Street cronies? Are they actually people who are prepared to lay down the law?
Yeah, I wonder what his friend Paul Tudor Jones, who raised a lot of money for him, is thinking. We have to bring it to a close there. Thank you for joining us, Dean Baker. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. You can check out his colleagues' writings on all these issues at ceper.net, CEPR.net on the web. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week, and let's go out with this another relic of 1968. From the Velvet Underground, I heard her call my name. Till next week. Bye.
They never stood a word for me because I know that you did tell me I heard it from my name. Little